Revelation 8. Revelation 8 begins with the opening of the seventh seal. And when John, or when the Lord had opened the seventh seal, there followed a silence in heaven about the space of half an hour. The only thing I can suggest about this is that when there is such a time as this, it is a time of anticipation on John's part. As any human, he would be wondering, well, what's going to happen? What's about to happen now? Just a heightened anticipation of what was to come. Beyond that, I don't know of anything that could properly be attributed to this. And so then, when things began moving along, verse 2, and I saw the seven angels that stand before God. Now, I have not seen any reference to these certain seven angels before. We've looked back in chapter 7 at four angels that are standing, holding the standing at the four corners of the earth, holding the four winds of the earth. We've seen various angels. We've seen the four living creatures. But I haven't seen a reference to a specific seven angels that stand before God. But that's okay, because all along we will learn some additional detail that we had not seen earlier. Now, for example, in Revelation 4, where we are seeing the throne room of God described, we do not there see these seven angels. Nor do we see a golden altar, which is going to be mentioned. So it is, I don't know, you know, when you're dealing with a vision, it's almost as if God will let you see the part of the vision that you need to see when you need to see it. And so it may be the kind of thing that John has not mentioned this before, either because it was not there or because it was not significant at that point. But I rather think that some of these things are things that just... Well, you remember about the Lamb standing as though He had been slain? Do you remember that when He first saw the throne scene in chapter 4, the Lamb wasn't there? And it was like suddenly, there the Lamb was. And I think it's more likely that kind of thing. And so, these seven angels stand before God, and there were given unto them seven trumpets. So I can't really tell you anything about these angels except what is said here. Beyond that, we don't know anything. They're holding seven trumpets. Now, to understand trumpets, what we have to do is just say, okay, what are trumpets used for? And we can't make up stuff, see? We know that. We can't make up stuff. We've got to say, what are trumpets used for? Now, fortunately, in the Bible, we have a great deal of information on trumpets. Before Moses and the children of Israel left Mount Sinai, they made two silver trumpets. And those silver trumpets were to be used for signaling. They signaled. Sometimes they signaled an alarm. Sometimes they signaled an assembly. Sometimes they signaled other things like time to depart or something like that. So that we can certainly say that trumpets are for signaling. And I think in the context here, particularly with warning, the idea of warning or sounding an alarm, here is something that calls our attention and we see, and here is something that is going on. So the trumpets, I believe, would fit into the idea of a warning. So here we have warnings that are about to be given. And another thing, when we have considered the seven seals, and this is the opening of the seventh seal, and now we're going to have the seven trumpets. And in 15 and 16, chapters 15 and 16, we're going to have the seven bowls of wrath. Instead of those things being sequential, in other words, you have all the stuff in the seven seals happening first chronologically, then chronologically we have the seven trumpets, and then chronologically we have the bowls of wrath. No, I don't think that's so. I rather think that what we've got in each of these series of seven is a different way of looking at history and time and the events that occur in time. And God is making various points about these. So we've already looked in the seven seals and made the point there that I think that the idea is that along with the preaching of the gospel, the appearance of Jesus, the work of the Christ, the work of the Messiah, which is the overall, the most important factor going on in this whole era. Right? Everybody with me? That's the most important factor going on in this whole era. But in addition with that, there are other forces at work that the people of this world, including Christians, especially Christians in the vision, must deal with. And so these include death as a result of war, violence, famine, death, pestilence, all kinds of things like this. But now we're going to look at history from another viewpoint. And one of the reasons why God does not just come on and finish this up right here is because He's saying, now wait a minute, before we finish, I want to give you another angle to look at. Here's another angle to look at. Because you see, as the saints have their questions are answered when they see God's viewpoint. When the saints look at history from God's viewpoint, then more of their questions are answered and they receive comfort. So I believe it is better for us to understand that each one of these series of sevens, primarily the seven seals, the seven trumpets, and the seven bowls of wrath, are all parallel but different ways of looking at the things that happen in this world. And so that's what God is wanting us to see. The saints, this is a message to the saints to assure them and to comfort them. And so that's that we've got to keep that in mind as we go along. All right, as the angels get ready to sound their trumpets. Now let's see what happens. Verse 3. And another angel came. Okay, this would be another angel besides the seven angels. This is not an angel with a trumpet. This is another angel. He has another job to do. Another angel came and stood over the altar, having a golden censer. Now, we read about an altar, but it's in chapter 6, not back in chapter 4. What is the reference to the altar in chapter 6? All right, the souls that have been slain are beneath the altar. Now, everyone remembers that? See, we have an altar mentioned in 6. The angel came and stood over the altar having a golden censer. And remember that a censer is some kind of a bowl. It is a bowl. That's the best way to describe it. It is a bowl. Now, the censers were fixed so that they could be carried. You see, obviously, what is the problem with carrying a metal bowl filled with hot coals? You're going to get burned unless you have a way to carry it without immediate contact. Well, we don't have details about this censer, and the angel could have handled it. It wouldn't have been a problem to him either way. But I'm just wanting you to know what a censer is. Sometimes when we're dealing with a word like that, if it is like censer, we're not used to censers. I want to make sure you know what that is. Is that what it says in most of your translations there in verse 8:3? Does it say censer? Okay. I just want to be sure. So the censer is just a metal bowl. This one's made of gold. And the censer would have hot coals put upon it. And both in the Old Testament, like Leviticus 16:25, the coals were to come from the altar of burnt sacrifice. Do you think there may be a little bit of a parallel between the idea that in the Old Testament the coals with which incense was to be burned came from the altar of burnt sacrifice, and here the this golden bowl is in connection with the golden altar which is here before the throne of God? I think there's definitely a parallel. All right, so this angel comes, he stands over the altar having a golden censer. there was given unto him much incense that he should add it unto the prayers of all the saints upon the golden altar which was before the throne. Now take just a moment, go back to chapter 5 and verse 8 where there's a reference to the idea of the incense. Revelation 5 verse 8. And when he had taken the book, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb, having each one a harp and golden bowls full of incense, which are the prayers of the saints. So that the incense here is called the prayers of the saints. It's not something in that verse in addition to the prayers. It is which are the prayers of the saints. In chapter 8 and verse 3, the wording could be like this. And another angel came and stood over the altar having a golden censer, and there was given unto him much incense that he should give it, unto the prayers of all the saints upon the golden altar which was before the throne. And the smoke of the incense, and then that word with the prayers of the saints, could equally be translated for the prayers of the saints. So that we see a little bit more harmony between the verse in 8:3 and the verse in 5:8 when we understand that the incense is probably more to be identified with the prayers of the saints. If it is something that accompanies the prayers of the saints, what would you think it most likely would be? What would be the idea of something that accompanies the prayers of the saints to make those prayers acceptable unto God? The intercession of Christ. What did you say, Bill? For the idea of forgiveness. Is that what you said? Oh, okay. So, in either case, whether it is the incense is the prayers of the saints, as it says in 5:8, it may be that there's an additional idea here. That's certainly possible, and I don't want to rule that out. So in 8:3, it may be adding a dimension to it, adding another idea to it, that here the prayers of the saints are going up and in connection with incense. Now, in the Old Testament, of course, we know about incense, the incense that was offered very, very often every day. In Psalm 141, I'll just read you a verse. Psalm 141, verse 2, the psalmist says, "Let my prayer be set forth as incense before thee." See that idea? In the sense that when incense comes up before you, what is incense supposed to do anyhow? What is incense supposed to do? You know, what is that? It's supposed to have a pleasant odor, a sweet smell, pleasing, right? Something that's pleasing. The writer here in the psalm says, "Let my prayer be as incense before thee," which means a prayer to God, to let my prayer be pleasant to come before you. And that has to do with, you know, I think that really ties in with things that for my prayer to be pleasant when it comes before God, for your prayer to be pleasant when it comes before God, what do you think has to be true? Just generally. Okay, what, Doug? All right. We have to be in a relationship with God where we are His children and He is our Father. And Buford, what? Has to be in faith. Has to be with a consistent lifestyle, doesn't it? A lifestyle consistent with one who claims to be in the service of God. Right. That's right. Yeah, that's true. All right, so the angel is offering this, the prayers of all the saints. Now, I think that one of the most powerful things to observe here is that a lot of what happens in Revelation is shown as the answer of God to prayer. Now, you and I really need to give some thought to that. You know, I know I do, and I believe you do too. Now, one of the most practical, if not one of the most powerful lessons in Revelation is the role that is played by the prayers of the saints. And we've got back in chapter 5 and verse 8 already about the golden bowls full of incense, which are the prayers of the saints. We have the saints beneath the altar crying, "How long, O Lord, till you avenge our blood on them that dwell on the earth?" You've got these cries that go forth. These are the prayers of the saints. And one of the things that God is showing us is that in all that He is doing in history, it is not just what He is doing and what He is thinking. He's the only one involved. He has chosen to involve us as well. Now, He could have done it without involving us. I have no doubt whatever of that. That is not what He chose to do. And one of the great powerful messages of Revelation is that God has chosen to involve us as saints with what is going on. So, one of the things that you and I really need to do, I don't know how much more time we need to give to this in our own lives, but we need to think about living so as to make my prayers acceptable unto God, being sure that I'm doing that in every aspect of my life. Secondly, fervently praying unto God. Now, that kind of ties together the point you were making, Bill, not only being a righteous man, but praying effectual, fervent prayers. And so that is a very important task. Don't you sometimes wonder, what can I do? You look at the world today, you look at what is going on in the world today, and it's easy to even be frightened about what's going on in the world today. It's certainly easy to be depressed about what's going on in the world today. And sometimes you and I get the feeling, well, there's nothing I can do, not a thing I can do. One of the greatest powerful lessons in Revelation is that one of the most important things we can do is pray. And pray as it ought to be done. And look at the result. This is interesting here. Verse 4, "The smoke of the incense with the prayers of the saints went up before God out of the angel's hand." So there are the prayers going up. "And the angel takes the censer and fills it with the fire of the altar and casts it upon the earth." Which means instant results. It's portrayed as here the prayers go up and things begin to happen. See that? Prayers go up, things begin to happen. So that's the message He's wanting us to understand. I think one reason why we need that message in Revelation, and I'm not just saying the book of Revelation, but I'm saying in Revelation generally, God reveals that to us because sometimes when we pray, the prayer is not immediately granted right there before us. And it is awfully easy to wonder, is the prayer being heard? Is God going to answer it? We need the assurance that we have here that prayer is very powerful before God. But we must remember it has to be the prayer that is delivered from one who is living the lifestyle that shows he's committed unto God and His leadership. Buford? Yeah, looking at Jesus in the immediate situation, it would look like He had been abandoned. But actually, He was not abandoned because God was there for Him.
And talking about praying for us, we don't always know exactly what to say. That's the reason Paul said that the Holy Spirit makes for us groanings which we cannot utter.
Right.
But we don't know how to verbalize.
Right. I'm so glad that is true, because I think there are so many times that I'm faced with the idea, what should I pray for here? And I think that at times like that, the best thing we can do is just say, Lord, I don't know what to pray for here. And I leave it in Your hands to do what is best for me or for whomever I pray. Another passage that I think is really, really powerful and beautiful on the point here is in the 18th Psalm, which is actually a song that David wrote. It is recorded in 2 Samuel 22 as well as in the 18th Psalm. And, of course, I'm not going to look at the whole psalm, but I do want to show you the first part of it. In the first six verses, David says, I love You, O Lord, my strength. The Lord is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer, my God, my rock, in whom I will take refuge, my shield and the horn of my salvation, my high tower. I will call upon the Lord, who is worthy to be praised. So shall I be saved from mine enemies. The cords of death compassed me, and the floods of ungodliness made me afraid. The cords of Sheol were round about me. The snares of death came upon me. In my distress, I called upon the Lord and cried unto my God. Now those verses set forth the distress of the psalmist and the fact that in that distress he cried unto the Lord. Now listen. He heard my voice out of his temple, and my cry before him came into his ears. Then the earth shook and trembled. The foundations also of the mountains quaked and were shaken because he was wroth. There went up a smoke out of his nostrils, and fire out of his mouth devoured. Coals were kindled by it. He bowed the heavens also and came down. And as it goes on, do you see the point in the psalm? The psalm is David praising God for being so powerful in acting in his behalf when he called upon him. So it's a very, very good and very powerful lesson for us to observe here. Oh, yes. Yes. Right. So eminently surrounded by danger and so on. In other words, when you're eating and you're giving thanks for the food, go ahead.
A lot of times, I feel day to day, time to time, I'm repeating.
Okay. Well, you are, and it's okay. It's okay, because you remember in the prayer that Jesus told us to pray, you know, that so-called model prayer. One of the things he said was, when you pray, give us this day. He didn't say, give us this week, give us this month. He said, give us this day, our daily bread. So if you follow just generally the instructions that he gave there, then every day I would be praying, give me this day, my daily bread. Yeah, Doug? Yeah, I think you're right. Okay. All right, now then, let's go on and look now at what happens as these angels that have the trumpets begin to blow. We've emphasized prayer, and I think it needs to be emphasized. But now let's look at the idea here of what happens as the seven angels that had the seven trumpets prepared themselves to sound. Now, I like that verse 6 there. You can just picture that. The seven angels prepared themselves to sound. So, does that mean they pick their trumpets up, or does it mean they put them up to their mouths and each one is going to take his turn? But in other words, you know, you're John, you're watching them, and they're getting whatever they do to get ready now, they're about to do it. And the first sounded, and there followed hail and fire, mingled with blood, and they were cast upon the earth. And the third part of the earth was burnt up, and the third part of the trees was burnt up, and all green grass was burnt up. Okay, so what are we going to do with that? Why don't we make up stuff? I know you don't want to do that. I don't want to do that. And I'm scared to make up stuff. All I can do is suggest some things for you to think about. I think that there are two primary explanations to consider. Two possible explanations to consider. And among the students of Revelation that I appreciate most, these are the two explanations that I have seen. One is that the things that are referred to in the first four angels sounding their trumpets are references to earthly catastrophes that occur. And the earthly catastrophes that occur are to make us think, and thus it constitutes a warning. And I'm pretty sure at various times I have held that view. I don't consider that an evil view. I do believe that when we observe some terrible thing happening, let me give you an example. It's not Katrina. I'm not going to touch that. No, I'm going to deal with a Bible one. Do you remember Jesus and his discussion in Luke 13? He said, you know, here these men were at the Tower of Siloam, and the Tower of Siloam fell and killed, what, 30-something of them? 36 of them or something like that? Jesus said, do you think that those men were wicked above all other men? All right, now see, ponder that question. Here these men died when that tower fell on them. So did that tower falling on them mean that they were wicked above all other men? That's what Jesus asked. And his answer was, I tell you what, no. But unless what? Unless you repent, you shall all likewise perish. See, it's a warning. And it wasn't necessarily a thing saying how terrible they were. But one who is thinking right will ponder that. And I think that one of the things that it's a fact, whether this is the point he's making or not. I know it is a fact. That life is so tenuous. Before you can even imagine it, life can be gone. And it can be gone in so many ways. You and I have all heard of people who got up one Monday thinking they were healthy and found out that they were sick and were dead within a week. That kind of thing can happen. Or you get out and you're just going to do some little mundane job, driving your car. That can happen. And when we hear about catastrophes happening, one thing that ought to make us think about is what? Preparation, huh? Yeah. It makes us think about the need for us to be prepared. It also, and I think you're right, it makes us realize just how dependent our lives are. Every time I think about that, I think about Paul's statement in the Sermon on Mars Hill, in Him we live and move and have our very being. We live by God's grace. We live by His sufferance. And we depend upon Him. Now, the Christians readily accept that view. They certainly should do that. What about the wicked? Do the wicked always pay heed to the warnings? Do they always listen and say, you know, that could have happened to me. I better straighten my life up. Does that happen? Unfortunately, it doesn't happen very often. But God does say, I'm warning. You know, here's the warning. I'm letting these things happen. I let these catastrophes happen. You see, in the Old Testament, I know that God specifically sent catastrophes. You know how I know that? Because it says so. I cannot interpret events today with that kind of certainty. But I know that the same purpose can be served, which is to warn that life is uncertain and all life is in the hands of God. Therefore, I need to take warning. Now, that would be a very fine thing here if that's what it was teaching. And that may be what it's teaching. I want to give you another view about what it may be teaching here. What it may be teaching here is by using various figures and symbols having to do with nations and cities and history and society. And what it may be talking about is the various ways that God sends judgments upon nations and cities and societies throughout history. And the fact is, this book was written in the time of one such nation, the Roman Empire. It was written in the time of one such great imperial city, such as Rome. It was written in the time when this nation and this society was completely lending its power to Satan for persecuting the saints. And so what God is pointing out is what He has taught throughout the Bible. And that is, what is the fate of a nation that opposes itself to God? What is the fate of any earthly nation? Destruction, oblivion. It's going to pass away. It doesn't matter which one it is. Eventually, it's going to pass away. But particularly when that nation lends its persecuting power to the devil, or when that nation loses all moral and spiritual moorings. And in my view, that's probably what he's saying with these trumpets. A threat and a warning about judgment upon the nations, that this is going to happen. And so with that in mind, let's go along and look at these things. But before we move along now, looking at the individual trumpets and what he said, does anyone have a comment that you'd like to offer? Jerry, you have a thought? Yes.
Because there, God's people are just expected to do whatever is going to happen. The judgment of God is taking place, and the scene is taking place. And so, in that, in verse 17, it's very, very clear that you've got two groups of people. And it may be that as that after seventh angel sound, the third voice, or it seems that point in time, there is that strong thing to make God's people are concealed and protected. And God's judgment has come upon those who do not get
equal. Right. And it mentions the nations were wroth, and your wrath came, and the time of the dead to be judged, and the time to give their reward to the servants, the prophets. Buford?
One thought that comes to my mind when you talk about the decline of nations. First is that the nations would be affected by natural calamity.
Yeah. And you know, those things, God rules in the affairs of men. And He uses historical forces to do that. And that really ties in exactly with what you said, Buford. Do you remember that one of the greatest passages in the Bible to help us to understand the point that God does rule in the affairs of men is Daniel 4. When you remember Nebuchadnezzar? Remember, because of his pride, he was driven away from men, was given the heart of a beast until seven times should pass over him, and until he might learn that God rules in the affairs of men. And in the various passages in Daniel 4 where he talks about that, he talks about God raising up whomsoever He will and bringing down whomsoever He will and all of that. Paul, in Acts 17, so far as I'm concerned, in Acts 17, Paul affirms that those same principles that we observe in operation in the Old Testament are operable now. Because he said, He made of one every nation of men to dwell on all the face of the earth, having determined their appointed seasons and the bounds of their habitation. See, this is God, and this is today. So, God does rule in the affairs of men. And it is interesting, Buford, you know, you think about internal catastrophes that happen. And then the way a nation deals with that. If the nation is a strong nation with a lot of moral fiber, spiritual commitment, they just take it on. But as the inner strength of a nation begins to decline, what about its ability to take a hit and rebound? What happens to that ability? It is not as resilient. It erodes. We don't have the strength. We don't have the toughness because of that lack. Yeah, corruption. Of course, Gibbon, if you ever want... Gibbon, you know, wrote The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. Now, I have read some of Gibbon, and I'm sure it is wonderful stuff. But I have found that it would probably be better generally if you were needing to get to sleep. But he does point out, in connection with the reasons for the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, it's a very interesting list of things, and they involve, you know, a lot of what we've been talking about. So, yeah, the political corruption, the moral decay, the downfall of the family, and, you know, lots of things like that. Having your army composed mainly of people outside. To any people. That's right. All right, so that's good. Those are good points. I really appreciate that. Now, in verse 7, when it mentions the hail and the fire mingled with blood, when we think about hail, if I kind of run a search in the Old Testament, maybe what's one of the most notable events involving hail that we remember in the Old Testament? The plague, probably. There's more than one, but that would certainly be probably the most prominent one, is the plague which involved hail. So since it was used by God as a chastisement upon Egypt, we have here hail, fire, mingled with blood, which of course the idea of death, cast upon the earth, the third part of the earth was burnt up, and the third part of the trees was burnt up, and all green grass was burnt up. All I can take that to mean is, like I said a while ago, it's either a symbol of natural catastrophes that occur from which the wicked should take warning, from which really everybody should take warning. But the Christian generally does take warning, and the wicked person does not. Or it is signifying the idea of the judgments of God upon the nations of the world. And as I said, I lean toward the latter, but I am not going to try to bind on you or force you to accept that. I've tried to set before you the different ideas. That this is not literal, I think, is true, because what kind of a disaster have you ever observed in which all the green grass is burned up? A third of the earth. It's symbolic. In other words, it's not a complete thing here. It's symbolic. There's a part of it here, a part of it there. And as you look at the world as a whole, usually that's the way it is. This nation or that nation or some nations are having it worse than others. Some nations fall. You just think how many nations that you can think of in your own lifetime that have risen and fallen. And I think that if you ever actually got down and started writing a list, and especially if you, I mean, I'd have to do a little bit of checking on some things, but it would be astonishing. So at any period in the world, you have this rising and the falling. And I think that historically, the biggest fall that has taken place in my lifetime, so far as nations are concerned, which one would it be? In my lifetime, what did you say? Russia, Soviet Union. Yeah, that's I think hands down, that's the biggest one. All right, look. All right, let's see. That's the first bell, right? Look at that second one in verse 8. The second angel sounded, and as it were a great mountain burning with fire was cast into the sea, and the third part of the sea became blood, and there died the third part of the creatures which were in the sea, even they that had life, and the third part of the ships was destroyed. So the first one affected the earth. This one affects the sea. And so if the explanation of just natural catastrophes, then this would have to do with catastrophes involving the sea and so on. But I believe that we're on maybe a little bit more certain ground as we try to interpret that one because of the way that mountains are used in the prophets and the way the sea is used in the prophets. Mountains are used in the prophets like Isaiah 2 and Micah 4 and other places as the basis of an empire, the basis of a kingdom, like where the capital is, or something like that. The great mountain is taken and cast into the sea. And I want to look up some verses on that, but we won't do it today. Not only the mountain, but also the way the sea is used. And I think that one of the most helpful passages on that is Daniel 7, where Daniel starts off with a vision describing that the wind was, it was a vision of here was the ocean right out in the middle of nowhere, and the wind was blowing and just whipping up the waves. There was a lot of agitation going on, and then he began to watch as four beasts came up out of that water. Okay, we'll look at this more Wednesday night.